just a note, right? Yeah.
Indeed, 1991, the time is 8:40. We have a quorum. I'm going to call to order the House State Affairs Committee meeting. Today is Wednesday, May 15th, 1991. Time is 8:40. We have a quorum and Representatives Moyer, Bruckman, Baker, Miller, Groomberg, and Kabina. Today we'll be hearing letters of report on the confirmation of Mr. Jack Anderson, Millen Keller, Eleanor Andrews, Seaborn Buckaloo. House Bill 42 relating to health benefits for part-time state employees. House Bill 155 relating to barrier-free remodeling fund. House Bill 157 relating to appropriation of barrier-free remodeling fund. House Bill 273 relating to payment for Medicare premium charges. House Bill 289 relating to change of inter-exchange carrier. House Bill 308 relating to adoption of emergency regulations. And anything else we might find of interest today. First thing I'd like to have before us, please, is House Bill 273, payment to Medicare premiums. We have heard this bill in work session. Accept a motion.
I'll offer a motion.
Representative Groomberg, there is a motion to move the bill with an individual recommendation, and would you include in that a letter?
Yes.
Stating some of the concerns brought out in the work session and request to the Finance Committee's looking into those.
Yes.
Ways of dealing with that.
Mm-hmm. Funding. I would simply ask that the commission.
We are in teleconference.
Okay, I move that the bill, House Bill 273, pass out of this committee with individual recommendations, Mr. Chairman, and I further move that the committee send a letter expressing our concerns about the fiscal impact to the Finance Committee. I would ask that the chair draft the letter, and before it goes out, just circulate a copy to the members of the committee informally on the floor or something so that we can let you know if any of us have any suggestions, but we don't need another meeting to discuss it.
Any objections? Hearing no objections, House Bill 273 is moved to the committee with individual recommendations. Next bill I'd like to bring up officially is House Bill 42 by Representative Ulmer, an act relating to benefits of state employees and permanent part-time positions. We have heard this bill in work session this morning, and have more questions on the bill. House Bill 42 will remain in committee and be heard at a future date. Are there any objections to that? There are none. We will, who wishes the committee? Do you want to, I have some teleconference. We'll do 289 next. And then after that, we will do our letters.
Mr. Chairman,
I recognize Representative Choquette is here promptly at 8:45. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to respectfully request that perhaps we could take up the letters as quickly as possible. We do have a caucus scheduled at 9 a.m.
Okay.
So,
well, why don't we do that first then, and that won't take very much time. First of all, we have before us, let's take before us, we have had hearings on Mr. John Anderson to the position of a commission member of Alaska Public Offices Commission. Entertain a motion on this letter. And the motion simply needs to state that we are moving a letter with individual recommendations.
So moved.
There is a motion to move a letter for Mr. Anderson with individual recommendations. Are there objections? Hearing no objections. This letter is moved. entertain a motion on Mr. Miller Keller.
Motion.
Representative Choquette?
Yes, I move the letter.
Representative Choquette has moved a letter for the report of Mr. Miller Keller for Commissioner and Department Administration with individual recommendations. Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, the letter is so moved. The next letter I have before us is a letter on Mr. Seaborn Buckaloo to the Personnel Board. We have not interviewed Mr. Buckaloo. He was appointed by Governor Cooper. My understanding is that Mr. Buckaloo has been sworn in and sits on the Personnel Board. There was a letter from Governor Hickle withdrawing this nomination. We have a where's our file on the Personnel Board?
Yeah, I got one.
From the Judiciary Committee with legal opinions. Is that reporting here from Michigan from the Judiciary Committee? I brought it to you. We do have a report from the Judiciary Committee.
Dave, I think you have to do any other column if you do that.
Let's cross it on.
That's going to confuse the court.
I'm sorry, yeah. Just put a line through there and we do the same thing. We do have a report from the Judiciary Committee dealing with the situation. To put it in a nutshell, Governor Cooper has appointed certain people to various boards. The statute states that to remove people from the Personnel Board, it can only be done for cause. Governor Hickle has sent a letter saying that he's withdrawn the name of Seaborn Buckaloo from nomination. It is the Judiciary Committee opinion that he does not have the authority to do so, that people from the Personnel Board can only be removed for cause. Therefore, it is my intention to pass out a letter of recommendation to the joint session for tomorrow's hearing. Is there any discussion on that?
Yes, I'm going to make a motion that we endorse the Judiciary Committee's letter. But I would like to make sure we have a full complement of our committee here at the time. I'd ask Rex to go get Betty. So I think we'll just wait until she comes to take that motion.
Mr. Chairman, could we have some discussion?
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is to Representative Grunberg. Was Mr. Buckaloo and Ms. Andrews already on the, were they reappointed? Okay, so they were.
The answer to that is yes. Not reappointed. They were appointed after we last met in joint session at some time after May 1990. So they have been sitting on the board. These are not reappointments. I'm sorry, I missed.
Oh, okay. The other question, do you know what date they were appointed?
No, but they were appointed.
I don't have the packet.
President Donnelly, would you like to join us?
Mr. Chairman, do you have the full packet that was distributed to members yesterday?
I do have the packet in front of me.
In towards the back of the packet is a list of the dates of all the appointees in question. Okay, they were appointed in, looks like July. Yeah, I think these two were quite a while ago, right after we left. It's kind of a weak copy, Mr. Chairman. It's kind of a faxed, Xeroxed copy towards the back. I think it might be the next document down from where you are. Yeah, there it is. And if you look on there, it's under Personnel Board, and it would have the...
Term began for Bart on 7/11/90. According to this letter here.
Yeah, I see.
Did you have for Eleanor too?
Yeah, she was appointed 26th of July.
Correct.
Neither of them was a reappointment as far as I know.
And we do have before us the letter of recommendation on Seaborn Buckle at this time. Is there other comments from the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gruber.
At this time, I make two motions. I'll make one omnibus motion. That the first part is that we endorse the Judiciary Committee's, specifically in writing, endorse the Judiciary Committee's letter for both Ms. Andrews.
Would you specify what letter you're talking about?
Yeah, the one that you got right there, not the Judiciary.
Well, we have a whole packet.
Okay.
Are you talking about the 24th letter or?
No, I'm talking about the letter.
The executive summary you may be talking about.
No, no. Where's the letter that we've passed out?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Donnelly.
In the packet, there are two letters to Speaker Grusendorf. And I think you'll need to refer to the second letter. It should be in the second. There's a color page separating it, right below there. That should be it, Mr. Chairman.
The May 13th letter, Mr. President Donovan?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. That deals specifically with the issue presented by the appointments before the committee at this time. Mr. Chairman, I do not have any packet. All I have is bill packets here.
It should have been in your box yesterday.
Oh, okay, well. That is correct, Mr. Chairman. They were distributed to the members.
Maybe you have a copy that we could pass.
I don't, it wasn't in my box, Mr. Chairman.
No, but I have mine personally.
I can guarantee it was in the members' boxes yesterday because I personally checked them.
Yeah, I have mine.
I have two copies of the same letter.
Yes, you're right. Okay, I withdraw the first attempt at my motion, Mr. Chairman, and I'll move this time that we pass the two nominations, Buckaloo and Andrews, out with individual recommendations, and then once people have had a chance to view the Judiciary letter,
I'd like
then
to
we'll
deal
take
with
that
them separately.
Yeah.
But one at a time. So let's
I'm just going to say I'll wait until people have a chance. Oh, the two. Okay. First time, I move that we send out the report out the nomination of Seaborn J. Buckaloo Jr. with individual recommendations.
There is a motion to move out a letter on Seaborn Buckaloo. Is there objections to moving out the letter? Hearing no objections, we will move the letter. Is there any other discussion?
I move.
Just any other discussion on Buckaloo? Hearing none, the next item I'd like to take up is that of Eleanor Andrews to the Personnel Board. Discussion?
I move the...
Representative Bloomberg?
Sure. I move that nomination, Eleanor Andrews, with individual recommendations.
There's a motion to move the letter of confirmation on Eleanor Andrews with individual recommendations. Is there objection? Hearing no objections, we have moved the letter of recommendation or letter of confirmation on Eleanor Andrews.
Seaborn Buckle wasn't a judge, Mr. Chairman.
That is him.
I got it. Somebody with a name like this.
Well, just so you know, Judge Buckle was Superior Court judge for about 15 years and was a fine judge.
Representative Donnelly?
He was the first judge I ever practiced law in, Mr. Chairman. He was also a delegate to the State Constitutional Convention.
He was a state senator, too.
Certainly no one is...
Well, that's a stretch.
No one is questioning...
and Ms. Andrews was the Commissioner of Administration.
Qualifications of these fine people. There is now, I'm now passing to the committee a letter from Representative Donnelly, the House Judiciary Committee. It's updated May 13, 1991, Representative Grunberg.
This was done by official motion of the committee, so it was a formal committee.
I'll accept the motion, Representative Grunberg.
I'd like to give people a chance to read it first when they're ready. Are you ready for a motion, or do you still want to read?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Representative Grunberg, this letter has already been sent from the judiciary.
That's right. What I am suggesting would be a one-paragraph letter that would say, by motion, the House State Affairs Committee endorses the attached May 13 letter of the House Judiciary Committee with respect to the two nominees for the Personnel Board, Buckley and Andrews.
And I will object.
I will object.
Oh, I would support.
Mr. Chair.
I call for a roll call here.
You made a motion.
I moved the letter. There's been objection, but I asked for a roll call vote.
One moment.
2-3.
I count seven.
One moment.
I can see you're bucking for the Finance Committee.
Could we, where are we? Can we maintain a little decorum, please?
We only have a little.
All right, Representative Grunberg, would you restate your motion, please?
Yes. Briefly, since it's already on the record. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. This is Representative Grunberg. Briefly, since it's already on the record, I move that this committee formally endorse the Judiciary May 13 letter signed by Representative Donnelly to Speaker Grusendorf and incorporate that by reference and attach it to our cover letter with respect to the two personnel appointees, Buckley and Andrews.
I will object, Mr.
And there is a motion on the table. There is objection by Representative Miller. Comments from the committee? Discussion? Hearing no discussion, we'll have a roll call vote on the motion to endorse the letter of Representative Donnelly from the Judiciary Committee of May 13, 1991. Representative Grunberg.
Aye.
Representative Miller.
No.
Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Bruckman.
Aye.
Representative Choquette.
No.
Representative Moyer.
Aye.
Representative Kavina. Aye. The motion passes 4-3. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I didn't press this down. My vote was aye.
Oh, I didn't press it either.
Further discussion on this item?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Choquette.
Request that the letter reflect the vote.
Was there, I didn't hear of anything about a letter. All I heard was an endorsement.
No, the motion, Mr. Chairman, was that we send the letter.
And who are we sending the letter to?
Grusendorf.
To the Speaker.
Yeah.
The letter will reflect the vote.
Thank you.
Sure.
Anything else on this issue? Hearing nothing. Thank you very much.
We'll look out for your interest here. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Nice being with you.
Yeah.
The next item before us is House Bill 289, Change of Interchange Carriers. House Bill 289, an act relating to regulation of the process of changing a telephone customer's selection of an interchange carrier, providing for effective date. First thing I'd like to hear on this is the Alaska Public Officers Commission, or Utilities Commission, excuse me. Mr. O'Tierney, are you online on teleconference?
Sir, can I
ask? Yes, sir, I can. Would you please state your name, your position for the record, and give us your testimony on House Bill 289, Labor and Commerce Version.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Kabina, and members of the committee, my name is Daniel Patrick O'Tierney. I am the lawyer member of the Alaska Public Utilities Commission currently. I'm also actually the former chairman of the Alaska Public Officers Commission, which you referred to initially, so you were closer to accuracy than you might have thought. In any event, I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Public Utilities Commission and have been also on this bill as it made its way through the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm adjusting the mic here. Give me one second. I'll start by saying, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, that the commission's position has been consistent throughout this time and before both committees, in that the commission doesn't really believe this bill is necessary to the extent that the commission has already passed a regulation which it feels addresses the problem that's been identified and in an adequate fashion for present purposes. And that regulation is 3 AAC 52.390 per n small d. And it says, as follows, it's very short, so I'll read it to you. A message telephone service subscriber of an interexchange carrier may not be transferred to another interexchange carrier unless the subscriber signs a written request for the change. You should have a copy of that, Mr. Chairman, if all of the materials were transferred to you from the House Labor and Commerce Committee that were filed by myself as well as other commenters before that committee. Having said that, I just want to spend a couple of minutes on, by way of background, on what we're on about here with this bill, and then since the original HB 289 is not before you, I will give you a very cursory reaction to that bill, and then give you a slightly more detailed one to the current committee substitute, which the commission reviewed favorably. First of all, the point here is that the commission saw a need for, and apparently this committee, since this bill originated here, saw a need for an address of problems which have occurred outside in terms of unauthorized switching of customers in the wake of the competitive playing field for long-distance service. Commission saw that there have been problems outside. It took what it thought was the most conservative approach to this by requiring a written representation of customer consent to switch his or her carrier. During the hearings and proceedings before the commission, MCI and GCI, for example, argued that a writing was too onerous in a competitive atmosphere, whereas Alascom, as I recall, argued that a writing was very necessary and was not too onerous. The commission essentially agreed with that offering by Alascom and adopted the regulation that I just read to you. The commission saw that, frankly, as the most conservative and best way of ensuring that a customer's consent was evident and assured. That is a writing. Having said that, the commission was not convinced at the time that there was necessarily evidence of a need for the regulation, but thought that it was the best foot forward in terms of preventing a problem to the extent it would be posed before us once the competitive regime took off in Alaska. What we're currently trying to do here, and what I'd like the committee to keep in mind, is a balancing act. What's really going on here is an attempt to balance consumer convenience and the allowance for the ability of a consumer to make his or her choices as freely and as informedly as possible in a competitive marketplace, but try to balance that desire with the desire for a certain amount of consumer or customer protection. Certainly a writing, as I've indicated just a moment ago, is the most conservative means of ensuring that customer consent has been obtained before a switch in his or her long-distance carrier is made. Also in the balance, perhaps I should mention there has to be some notice of the cost of doing business. And I think that both from an IXC point of view, but probably more particularly from a local exchange carrier's point of view, there will be cost of doing business involved that they will be mindful of in terms of administering and handling this written consent that the commission has already required in this reg, and which, if this bill eventually passes, the legislature will have further required. With that by way of background, I will simply say the original bill, HB 289, was, in the commission's opinion, too complex. There were ambiguous terms used in such a way as to create ambiguities. There were also inconsistencies in the original bill. Quite frankly, the commission, in its wisdom, thought that the bill was an example of over-regulation. It was over-exacting in its attempt to address the perceived problem or the potential problem of unauthorized switching. Therefore, the commission participated in the drafting of the committee substitute, which is now before you, and to the extent the legislature believes this bill is necessary, the committee substitute which you have before you is a good one. It's certainly one that the commission can live with. I think that it's simple. It's very straightforward. It calls a customer request exactly that. It calls the writing by the customer exactly that. It does not use terms like confirmations and change orders, et cetera, which lend themselves to confusion, at least in the commission's view. It requires one writing by the customer, which the commission has already promulgated a regulation about. It also provides for a certain level of informed consent. And finally, it provides for either a communication from a customer directly to a local exchange carrier that he or she wishes to change his long-distance carrier, or a notification from the long-distance carrier to the local exchange carrier that a customer wishes to change. I want to just spend a moment on that in just a second, because I know, Chairman Tribuna, that you have some interest in that point. Well, I'll do that. Actually, I'll do that right now, and then I'll close and allow Mr. Winnell and Ms. Williams to address this bill. Mr. Chairman, I understand that you have some interest in what the Lex role will be in terms of the handling of or as the ultimate repository for these written consents that this bill would require, and which the commission has already required in its regulation. I want to make one distinction for you and then give you my opinion on behalf of the commission on this point and what we envision. The distinction is this. You need to realize that there's a difference between the local exchange company being the ultimate repository for these writings, these written consents from the customer, and the difference between that and any perceived need for the local exchange company to have in hand the writing before the switching carriers can be made. I hope I've made that distinction as clearly for you. And the reason I make it is this. It's the commission's view at this point that there is no need to make a sort of preemptive strike in this area. In other words, it's the commission's view that we ought to allow the system to work like this, either as the current committee substitute allows for. Either a customer directly goes to his local exchange company and says, I want to change my carrier, and then signs off on the written authorization, and that writing would stay with the local exchange company. The other option, which allows for a dynamic interplay in the market, is for the IXC to be able to notify the LEC in a certified fashion that they have a writing from a customer who wishes to be switched, and then allow for the local exchange company to make that switch. The commission has not addressed, the committee, Mr. Chairman, may find it significant to do so, or some people did do so, but the commission has not addressed whether or not all of these writings ultimately lie with the local exchange company. That may be a fine idea, Commission. I don't think we have any problem with that. But at this point, the commission would have a problem with requiring the local exchange company to have the writing in hand before the switch can be made. For three reasons. One, comments for the moment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
You want to answer any questions?
Reps, thank you, Mr. Attorney. Representative Bruckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Betty Bruckman. And, Mr. Attorney, I have a couple of questions. When did APUC put in the regulations? At what date?
I can't remember the exact date, but the regs were required to be in effect and required by the legislature as a result of the passage of last year's then known SB 206 by February 15th, 1991. We met that required date, so it was in effect as of that point in time. The reg you're referring to is 3 AAC 52.390 per m small b. It's a reg that is a part of the entire package that we promulgated in response to SB 206, which creates the market structure and basically the rules for the competitive arena into which we're about to enter.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney. I'm also on Labor and Commerce and sat through the hearings that we had on the same bill. In this packet, I do not see the backup we had in that committee, the evidence of slamming that had occurred. That's why I asked you the date, because I thought that might be pertinent. But there was quite a bit of evidence of slamming techniques used by the telephone industry and the unhappiness of some consumers and their or this bill. Thank you.
Some questions, and or will you be able to stay with us through this testimony?
To me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Attorney, will you be able to stay with us through this testimony?
Sir, I will. I will stick by.
Thank you. Let me hear if we could from here in Juneau from Gail Carey, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gail Gary, and I am with MCI Telecommunications Corporation, a long-distance telecommunications provider. And I'm here to express our concerns about HB 289 and its effect on consumers in the competitive marketplace. As you've heard today, the Alaska intrastate market is just now being opened up to competition. And it's unclear what the effect will be of the existing rule passed by the Alaska Public Utility Commission, which Commissioner O'Tierney explained, requires a written signature before a consumer can change their long-distance service. The bill before you today, HB 289, basically will codify this rule and then will take away any flexibility that the APUC would have to readdress this issue if the rule is found to be overburdensome or if there's any need to go back and to change the bill. To date, no states require written signatures for consumers who change their long-distance service over the phone. California did pass legislation which requires a written signature be obtained before with a sale is made in person, such as at a trade show or something like that. But the law does not apply to sales that are made over the telephone. And until recently, the Federal Communications Commission has refused to require written authorization. And it's MCI's belief that mandatory written letters of authorization or written signatures by the consumer have anti-competitive consequences. Such practices, we believe, would effectively lock in the current market share by making it unduly cumbersome for a consumer to change their long-distance service, thereby providing the dominant carrier with reinforcing its position in the marketplace. Today, consumers routinely purchase goods and services over the telephone, which is a convenient and efficient way to conduct business. They're used to making the phone call, making the decision, having it implemented immediately, and not having to wait for something to come back for them to sign and then to return it. It's MCI's experience that people are not accustomed to sending in a written confirmation back to the carrier. Frequently, consumers ignore the packet of information. They either throw it away along with the rest of the junk mail, basically throw it in their pile of bills to be paid, then thereby delaying the service or the implementation of the service, or basically don't understand the significance of signing the confirmation form that they're changing is dependent upon that form being returned. With the advent of equal access for competitors on an interstate basis, the FCC did originally look at this issue and did require written signatures before a consumer could change their service. But because of the objections raised at the time, they changed that order to require that companies institute steps designed to obtain a letter of agency or a written signature. Thereby, they repealed the requirement that a long-distance carrier have to have on hand the written signature. There is, however, currently a rulemaking before the FCC, which I think you have a copy of in your packet, to revisit this whole issue to decide whether the existing rules need to be changed. We have filed comments in support of the current proposal being considered at the FCC. It's basically an outcropping of an MCI AT&T settlement and of a suit and countersuit between the two companies regarding advertising and telemarketing practices. During this, you know, the whole process, and you heard a little bit about it today in terms of the allegations of slamming or unauthorized conversions. But basically, what we've kind of learned through the process is that there are basically kind of three things that happen that all kind of get lumped into this category of slamming or unauthorized conversions. The first thing is that you do on occasion have bogus orders or an overzealous salesperson. And what I can tell you is that it's not in the best interest of MCI, Alascom, or any other company to engage in false or deceptive sales tactics or to switch a customer without their permission. MCI, just as every other company, is seeking to have a long-term relationship with their consumer, and it's not in our best interest to switch somebody and basically kind of blow that credibility just for that short-term revenue that we may gain, because we will lose long-term revenue overall. The second thing that can happen is called buyer's remorse. Maybe somebody doesn't like to say no over the phone, or perhaps, you know, a couple of hours later they change their mind and think, well, maybe I shouldn't have switched. Or perhaps you have a dispute kind of in the household between who should actually make that decision. MCI does have a policy, kind of a 90-day policy, that if a consumer does come back to us and decide that they want to switch back to their original carrier, that they can do that with no charge to the customer. The California legislation also addressed this and basically put that into law too, that there's kind of a 90-day grace period. The third thing that happens is human error magnified by computers. Basically, the whole telemarketing process is all done electronically, but if someone types in the wrong number, then you've switched somebody who didn't authorize that. So the rulemaking before the FCC basically recognizes that there are some problems and that perhaps there need to be some safeguards put in place, but it also recognizes that there needs to be some flexibility put in place for the long-distance carrier and their marketing process. The rulemaking basically proposes to do three things, and it allows the carriers three different methods to verify a sales. The first option is that the carrier have on hand a written signature. The second is that the carrier can set up basically an 800 number or a toll-free number, allowing the consumer, after they've received the telemarketing call, to call back that number to verify the name, the billing address, all of the information, and thereby you have an electronic verification of the sale. And the third option would be then the long-distance carrier employs a independent third party to basically call the consumer back and verify the billing information and all the information, and that they do indeed want to change their long-distance service. There are also a couple of additional safeguards. One of those is an auditing requirement to make sure that the provisions are being followed and that all of the orders that are being placed with the local exchange company are verified in one of the three ways. And the second safeguard is, once again, the company is required to employ an independent company to basically listen to make sure that there are no telemarketers out there making any blatantly false or misleading statements. And this is to be done, there's an audit to be done on a quarterly basis. If the independent auditor finds that there are problems, they then have to step that up and do monthly audits until the problems are corrected. Once again, the cost of that independent audit is borne by the inter-exchange carrier, so it's really not, again, in the benefit of the inter-exchange carrier to have those audits done on a monthly basis. As I'd just like to finish by encouraging you to oppose HB 289. You know, we don't believe that it's necessary right now. We'd like to say, just to give the marketplace some time to settle into competition and to see what the effect the APUC rule will have on consumers in the competitive marketplace. But I guess I would say, if you do intend to change the APUC rule, then I'd encourage you to consider adopting the three alternative verification methods that are currently being considered by the FCC to provide the long-distance carrier some flexibility while still protecting the consumers.
Ms. Ann Breckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In real estate, a person has to wait a number of hours before the deal is actually closed by the banking institution. In door-to-door sales, the customer is given 3 days to cancel because of the pressure that they can put upon that customer. I see nothing wrong in having verification by mail. And if the FCC should change its rules, then we can deal with it at that point in time. I appreciate your concerns, but also appreciate that of a consumer who is hit by an intense sales pitch who would make a sudden decision. And I'm used to waiting. In today's society, there are times that decisions can be made instantly, or instant gratification can occur. But frequently, you're sorry. And if a person is seriously changing, I see the having that in writing is a benefit to all the firms involved. I don't want to argue with you, I understand your side, but don't see where the written permission is that much different for your industry than what we do in society today.
Any comment, Ms. Carey?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruckman, we don't disagree, in terms of saying that there should be some sort of verification process in terms of some of the things that have happened. But we'd like to see some flexibility given to the long-distance industry in terms of either it being a written signature or the electronic verification or the third party.
Okay. If I may, and I certainly wouldn't want to accuse my children of doing something like this, but I certainly have heard of teenagers using the telephone with various credit cards. In other words, how does one verify that in fact is the person they're talking to?
Are you certified as a long-distance carrier at this time?
We're a long-distance provider on an interstate basis, but not on an intrastate basis in Alaska.
Representative Shilke.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. The position paper that's in our packet was written prior to the amendments out of Labor and Commerce. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And your position in terms of after the amendments is more or less we could live with the bill, but that it's not needed. Is that correct,
Mr. Chairman, Representative? Yes, although I'd like to basically say that at this time we don't believe that it is necessary, because as long as you have it already required through an APUC rule, you also then give the commission the flexibility to come back and say, okay, maybe this isn't working, maybe we do need to do something different. They can do that without us having to come back before you next session to change the law.
Is this regulation in effect right now, today?
Mr. Chairman, the whole market, and I think maybe Commissioner O'Toole might be able to answer this better, the whole market is starting to open up to competition, and it's my understanding that as that does that, this is indeed in place, the requirement is in place on an interstate basis.
Is the regulation in effect today? Do you know if the regulation that he's talking about, this regulation,
yes,
is in effect today?
Yes.
It
yes.
is? Representative Shilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm
Mr. O'Tierney, did you have a comment on that?
I was only saying, Mr. Chairman, that I was just responding to, I believe it was Representative Shilke's inquiry. Yes, it is. That regulation is effective upon the commencement of competition, which is due to commence due to the legislature's mandate today.
Mr. O'Tierney, in other words, the regulation is going, isn't that correct? As a matter of fact, is it correct that this regulation may not have even been adopted had not this legislation been brought forward?
Oh no, Mr. Chairman, the answer is a negative. The commission, let me see, I can find you some dates because I do have some copies of some of the original comments that were filed before the commission when we considered this. question, along with all of the other facets of the market structure that we have already promulgated the regulations about. For example, so the answer is an emphatic no to your question. Let me see if I can find them to give you more specific. Here, for example, Alascom filed its comments on this issue entitled Unauthorized Switching on page 47 of its reply comments, which were dated May 25th, 1990. That being a year ago, Mr. Chairman. Alascom, for example, filed its comments by way of reply comments to the Commission on this issue, where we were having the proceeding to consider this matter along with many other matters on the road to developing the regs, which have already been adopted.
Mr. Attorney, did the FCI, GCI, either of them support this regulation from the beginning, or did they oppose it?
My recollection, Mr. Chairman, is that when the Commission had its proceeding on this matter, as well as the many other matters responsive to last year's passage of SB 206, that FCI and GCI were not enamored of the idea of requiring a writing from the customer, a signed authorization. They thought that would be a bit cumbersome and onerous to the competitive marketplace and burdensome to consumer choice. I believe I made that statement earlier, probably not as clearly.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney. I'm trying to move somewhat rapidly. Another question. Will there be one depository or one place available to for inspection of this written comments or written authorization to change carriers, or will they be in multiple places, the way the bill is written now and the way your regulations are written?
The short answer to that, Mr. Chairman, is that there is no requirement that these written authorizations made by consumers will all end up being lodged in one location, for example. They can only be, however, in essentially two locations. In the hands of the local exchange carrier, if the customer went directly to his local exchange company and said, I would like to switch my long-distance carrier, or it would be in the hands of the long-distance carrier to whom the customer switched.
Mr. Attorney, what is wrong then with having, since the local exchange is the one that has to make the change, what is wrong with them having to keep that little piece of paper on file or either in the individual's records or just a separate file that says that has a copy of this person's one sheet that says they're exchanging so that anybody that want, if there's problems between the companies, there's one place for people to go and look at that, yes, that person did sign the record, rather than the two companies having to deal with each, or three companies, or four, however many there are, having to go to each other to look at this information, which is just going to cause problems between the companies. And what's wrong with that local exchange keeping that file? I don't understand why the hesitancy here of someone having the proof on file for people to see it. If people are doing things upright in an upfront manner, what do we have to hide?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that there is anything to hide. In fact, there will be every interest in the naked visibility of these writings so that there will never be any possibility of accusations of monkey business. But the answer to your question is I do not believe there is any particular problem with requiring the local companies, for example, to be the ultimate repository of the writings. I tried to distinguish that earlier from the point that the commission does not think it is a good idea and is not going to require at this point in its own wisdom that a switch cannot happen until the local company has that writing in its hands. We're willing to allow the switch to be made by the local company upon notification that the writing has been had, so to speak, that the writing is in migration of those writings for deposit with the local may be a very good idea. I'm not standing here today necessarily opposing that idea, if that answers your question. But I have made the distinction, which I think is an important one for your consideration.
Thank you. Representative Choquette, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we've seen in this legislature a number of times where comments from different agencies has been, well, we're already doing this now by regulation. It's being handled. It's being taken care of. The flip side of the previous testimony is obviously this does give some latitude to the commission, but it can go either way, that latitude. I have no problems with making regulations into law.
Thank you, Representative Choquette. Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, one of my questions was answered. I'm going to just go in reverse now because this local exchange thing has got me a little confused. In Fairbanks, for example, there are four phone companies, the military, MUS, Summit, or Cleary, whatever it's called, a private phone company, and then Telephone Utilities of the Northland, which, as far as I know, is an Alaskan subsidiary. So if the concern is the two competitors having to go and, I'm confused.
There's more than two competitors, I take it, and there's going to be more, but we're talking...
But in this case, one of the competitors owns the local exchange. So if you're concerned about a competitor having to come to a competitor's location to pick up this piece of paper, that's going to happen in Fairbanks. Because there are three of them are non-Alaskan, one is an Alaskan subsidiary.
I don't know either. Maybe we should go on and hear the other person's testimony, too, so that we get the other side of the story. Go ahead, Representative Moyer.
Well, Ms. Gary answered one of my questions in her subsequent remarks, and that was the other options. And I don't see the harm in giving APUC the power to consider several options. But another point that caught my attention was if this doesn't work, it may be back here next year for legislation. I wasn't part of the legislature last year as elected official, but I was around it. I thought this was all solved last year. I mean, truly, I thought the deal was they worked out a deal, so they wouldn't have to come back this year or next year. What's going on?
Comments?
Is there going to be a sponsor statement?
Well, I think if we let the next people testify, we might hear the other side of the story. Mr. Wannell? Don Wannell, are you there online?
Mr. Chairman, this is Don Wannell. May I ask if I'm being received on this microphone?
You're hearing fine. Please state your name, address, and who you represent, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Wannell. I'm Vice President for Regulatory Affairs for Pacific Telecom. I work in the offices of Pacific Telecom at 805 Broadway, Vancouver, Washington. I'm here this morning to testify on behalf of the committee substitute for House Bill number 289 and to also propose some matters for consideration to amplify the measure before you this morning. I would like to address remarks in the prepared portion, so to speak, to four areas. And then I'd be pleased to discuss any questions you may have. First, I'd like to review briefly for the committee the experience of the Federal Communications Commission with this subject matter. I would like to then address the second topic, what we believe are indications that the problem will eventually spread to Alaska and is, in fact, spreading even now, although today is nominally the first day of competition on the intrastate telecommunications market in the state. The third thing I'd like to review is briefly the benefits of this kind of legislation. And fourth, I would like to discuss four areas where we think the bill could be strengthened. And I will try and confine my remarks to about 60 seconds on each of those topics. First, with respect to the FCC, there is presently pending a notice of rulemaking, RM 7245, which was initiated 25 March 1991. And this proposed rulemaking is the culmination of approximately 6 years of experience at the federal level with precisely this problem. Initially, with the advent of equal access or competitive inter-exchange carriage in the lower 48, the FCC required what was then called a letter of agency and that had to be signed by a customer, and it had to be in the possession of an inter-exchange carrier. An inter-exchange carrier is simply somebody like Alascom, AT&T, GCI, or MCI. And that writing had to be signed, had to be in the possession of the inter-exchange carrier before a notification of a change could be made to a local exchange carrier. Now, in 1985, under pressures and similar representations that are now being made to you by various of the competitive inter-exchange carriers, such as MCI and GCI, the letter of agency requirement was changed to one of taking reasonable steps to try and obtain a letter of agency rather than actually obtaining one. And so, typically, an inter-exchange carrier would engage in telemarketing, would send a follow-up packet with a request for confirmation. But if and ever that response was made, it was not particularly the problem of either the local exchange carrier or the inter-exchange carrier. By 1990, even AT&T agreed that the experience was not satisfactory either to the companies involved or to the consumers in the marketplace because of massive incidents of slamming. I want to point out that this is not incremental. The Wall Street Journal, for example, estimated last year that there were at least 100,000 incidents of such. Bell Atlantic, one of the regional operating companies of the former Bell system, estimated for 1989 that in its regions alone there would be 80,000 incidences of unauthorized changes. And so the AT&T proposed a change in the FCC rules back to a written letter of agency and initiated a legal suit against MCI for fraudulent and deceptive marketing practices. MCI counterclaimed alleging similar practices by AT&T, and ultimately both AT&T and MCI agreed upon a settlement proposal. That settlement proposal largely appears as Appendix A in the FCC rulemaking. Now, the MCI representative, to the extent we could hear it here, did recite the terms of that correctly, but I believe a couple of points are worth noting. The FCC's proposed rulemaking, which it has tentatively adopted, pending comments of the parties, provides for three alternatives. First, that the inter-exchange carrier has an authorization card signed by the customer. Second, that the customer initiates a call to an automated number and records information which reasonably only that customer would have, such as name, address, the billing number, and so on. Or third, a customer change can be verified by an independent firm which is not affiliated with any long-distance company. The fourth provision, which bears note here, is that the FCC, in light of its experience and in light of the recommendations of AT&T and MCI, further has provided for a quality assurance program which is to be directed and managed by an independent auditor. The sum total of these provisions clearly is greater than anything either in the prior bill or the current committee substitute for House Bill number 289 being considered by the committee today, and yet the FCC does not consider this too onerous or too burdensome. Moreover, neither did MCI, at least at the federal level. They had the experience there, and they have agreed to these kinds of measures, at least on the interstate side. The measure before you today, notwithstanding the prior comments of MCI, is much less onerous than something they have already agreed to in another form. The experience, Mr. Chairman, on the interstate side, unfortunately, is not likely to remain merely on the interstate side. And I would like to turn to a discussion of the likely effects for intrastate competition here on this first day of the new year. We recognize and agree that the APUC has a regulation and did attempt to deal with this problem. I think it is fair to point out, however, several things. First, their regulation consists of one sentence, which Commissioner O'Tierney read to you. If you will examine that sentence, you will find that the following questions are completely unaddressed. First, who is it who has the legal obligation to procure this written authorization? We do not believe the regulation makes that point clear. Second, assuming somebody has the obligation to procure it, who is required to hold it? As Commissioner O'Tierney indicated, it could be the local exchange carrier, it could be the inter-exchange carrier. I guess it must be one or the other, but the regulation is silent as to which. The third question unanswered by the regulation is, who verified that any of this was done? Once again, we believe the regulation imposes no obligation either on the commission, its staff, the local exchange carrier, or the inter-exchange carrier for ensuring that the first two things, which are also unaddressed, are accomplished. In this circumstance, we think that a reasonable doubt might arise as to whether or not anyone will undertake to conform to this regulation. And indeed, we don't know how anyone would go about verifying it, assuming that there was an interest in doing so on somebody's part, since there is nowhere to assign accountability and responsibility for carrying out its terms. We know, secondly, that even if this regulation were otherwise clear, it is just a regulation. When the representatives mentioned a moment ago the notion of embodying regulations in a statute, a regulation, putting that notion conversely, can certainly be suspended by an agency, and indeed we have that case today. GCI has petitioned the APUC to suspend this singular defense of the consumer in the case of its conversion of customers in the Anchorage telephone utility. ATU represents approximately 40% of the access lines available competitively in the intrastate market. So while you are being told one thing in Juneau, that it is not necessary because there is a regulation of the APUC in effect, in Anchorage, there's a petition to suspend that regulation, just this one, and just for the purpose of approximately 40% of the market. We think that the combination of these circumstances reasonably calls into question whether or not the Commission's regulation is adequate for the task. What is that task? Well, the task is formidable. I have testified previously in this matter and supplied in that testimony examples of circumstances where customers of Alascom have been repatriated, if you will, as customers of GCI, not only without their consent, but in several instances over their express and repeated objection. GCI routinely sends out unsolicited calling cards identifying people as their new customer. GCI marketing practices have followed up these unsolicited cards with various forms of telemarketing pitches designed to confuse a customer, we believe, and to get them to convert prematurely and on inappropriate information away from Alascom services into GCI. GCI has, we think, a correct idea of competition, but carried to an extreme, the inadequacy of the regulation in this regard becomes apparent. In prior pleadings to the APUC, GCI said in one instance that throughout the numerous APUC proceedings during the last 18 months, the general premise has been that there could be and should be many certificated competitors in the market with various financial resources. In fact, there has been much discussion about the fly-by-night certificated competitor. The discussions have never centered on whether the fly-by-night entrant should be allowed into the market. This has always been a given. I don't know if that is good public policy. We recognize that on behalf of Pacific Telecom and its subsidiary Alascom, the competition is now the law of this state, and we intend to act accordingly. But to the extent that anybody can participate in this process, particularly as the current committee substitute permits, without even a certificate authorized by the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, we believe that the tendencies and the inherent, if you will, evils of telemarketing can be greatly exacerbated. A party not even subject to the regulations because they hold no certificate would be authorized to engage in solicitation. It is not too difficult, therefore, to foresee that somebody may come into the state, make a pro forma filing, and actually conduct a pre-marketing program with mailers and solicitations to determine what a prospective customer base might be. If they don't like the results, they simply leave the state and abandon their petition. What happens to all the customers who decided that they wanted to switch and are waiting, sign a die, as they say in the Senate and House, for a response from a company that never was certificated and is never going to operate in the state? We, of course, have much business before the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, and I would not want any of my remarks to be construed as a criticism of the commission or any of the commissioners. But I think we are entitled to ask in a non-rhetorical fashion, does a building have to catch fire before you install a sprinkler system? We think the answer is no. There's 6 years of hard evidence at the national level of what happened. Competition is about an hour and a half old, and we already have incidences of record involving it here. We are not castigating GCI. We agree that in many instances some things are inadvertent, but lots of inadvertencies can be cleared up when there is a standard and an enforced standard. From that perspective, let me turn fourth and last to the bill before you. We think it is a vast improvement over the commission's regulation, but there are four matters that I would draw to your attention for the committee's consideration. First, in subsection B, on the second page of the proposed legislation.
Mr. Wannell, could I interrupt a minute, please?
May not process a request to change carriers until, and item one says, a long-distance carrier notifies a local exchange carrier that the customer has signed a written request.
Mr. Wannell?
It's done. It can be done in a number of ways. We believe currently that GCI intends simply to send tapes of customer changes, that is, identifiers of the automatic number indicator, that is, line being billed for long-distance calls in the name of the party, and some form of affidavit saying all these things are appropriate.
Mr. Wannell, may I interrupt for a moment, please? Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, sir.
I apologize for interrupting you. We do have a time constraint here, as we are going being called to the floor for session. Do you have specific changes in writing that you would like to see done?
We will have shortly, yes, sir.
If I could ask you to please fax those to me at 465-2287. And my intention is... to recess this committee until the call of the chair, which will be whenever we get a break. The conference committee, finance conference committees, will be meeting this afternoon, and so we will have a break in the session today, at which time I plan on reconvening this committee. If you could fax to me your recommended changes prior to, let's say, well, as soon as you possibly could, so that we had those in writing, is that possible? Mr. Wannell, is that possible?
Yes, sir. We can have that fax to you this morning.
All right. I believe you've addressed your four concerns, and you're going to hit specifically at the bill. So if you would incorporate that in your fax so that we have that before us, and then we'll let you know as soon as we can the timing so that you... would you be available at that time, whenever that may be?
Of necessity, I would be happy to participate.
Thank you, sir. I would like to get just a brief comment from Deborah Williams, if I could, who is also on teleconference. Ms. Williams, are you available? Are you there?
I am, and I would be happy to give you brief comments now and then, as appropriate, to elaborate upon them this afternoon when you reconvene. I do think there are several crucial points that the commission should explore that I would like to present with you. First of all, let me just say...
Could you state, please, Ms. Wannell, who you, an address and who you represent?
My name is Deborah Williams.
Williams, excuse me.
I attend L Street, Anchorage, Alaska. I represent GCI and myself. As the other testifiers have stated, congratulations, today is the first day of intrastate competition. For those of you on the committee that participated in the passage of Senate Bill 206, thank you. And your constituents, thank you. Because for much of Alaska today, if they are GCI customers, they are enjoying lower rates than they had yesterday as Alascom customers. The legislature has accomplished a great deal. The APUC has accomplished a great deal in bringing competition to intrastate interchange services today.
I apologize again, please, Ms. Williams. we don't need a pep rally speech on this. Would you address the bill before us, or else I'll have to cut you off completely because of time constraints. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude.
I certainly will. The bill is the bill is unnecessary, and equally important, it is contrary to a solemn agreement that was made last year among Alascom, GCI, the APUC, and the legislature. I will repeat a question that was raised by one of the members of the committee, and that question is, what's going on? As responsible legislators, you need to ask yourself that question. And when you find that the answer is that Alascom is introducing this bill not to protect consumers, but rather to interfere very materially with the implementation of competition, I think you will decide not to pass this bill out of committee, because this bill will do tremendous damage to the implementation of competition, particularly in Anchorage. For those legislators who are from Anchorage, I can assure you, if you pass this bill with the intent that Alascom has behind this bill, you will be deluged with calls of complaint, because your consumers, your constituents will not be able to enjoy the benefits of competition. The APUC has, with incredible vigor, incredible care, gone through and analyzed and presented a structure for introducing competition. We don't agree with all the provisions. Alascom doesn't agree with all the provisions. But we made a solemn agreement last year in order to get the two initiatives off the ballot and in order to approve Senate Bill 206 that we would defer and the legislature would defer to the APUC to put together a competitive structure. They have done so. What is of incredible importance is listening with precision to what Alascom for the last year has asked the APUC to do with respect to written authorization and with respect to preventing slamming. I would like to quote, it is just one sentence, what Alascom asked the APUC to put in their regulations. They said, the commission should include the following provision in its regulations. One sentence. A message telephone customer of a long-distance carrier cannot be transferred to another long-distance carrier unless the customer requests the change in writing. That is almost verbatim, almost word for word what the PUC adopted. Alascom asked for a regulatory provision. They stated the exact words they wanted in that regulatory provision, and lo and behold, they got it.
I would be offended if
I were a member of the committee and heard Mr. Winnell's testimony when he said, oh, look, the APUC only passed one sentence, there are all these questions, et cetera, et cetera. Alascom has been in front of the APUC for the last year asking for the one sentence that the APUC adopted, and now Alascom is in front of you asking for legislation that is unnecessary. Alascom is being duplicitous.
So they'll just cut us off automatically.
Even if in front of the APUC and didn't ask for what they wanted, they'll have a hidden agenda here. And either should be absolutely unacceptable to the members of the committee. Alascom, after what it got, the regulation Alascom got is precisely what the APUC adopted. What is Alascom really trying to do here? They are trying to stop the implementation of competition in Anchorage. This is a complicated matter, and I'm sure Commissioner McKiernan would be happy to readdress this when we reconvene. But I can assure you that is their intent. The commission, because of the technology constraints in Anchorage and because of other considerations, came to a conclusion on the only way that competition could be implemented in Anchorage without consumers having to dial five extra digits. Alascom, in the hearings on this matter, justified itself that consumers would oppose warmly dialing
Ms.
five
Williams.
Extra digits. That is the only alternative commission had to implementing one pick on July 1. Alascom now is trying to interfere with that implementation and blow up competition because it's in their interest to stop competition in Anchorage. Don't do it. You don't want your constituents calling
Ms. Williams.
Why in the blankety blank am I having to dial five extra digits to make an interstate call? Don't do it. There is no reason to do this. The APUC passed what Alascom wanted. This is unnecessary. It has a hidden agenda. It is contrary to the solemn agreement that was reached. Please do not pass this piece of legislation. It is anti-consumer, anti-competitive, and unnecessary.
Ms. Williams, if you have any other recommendations other than do not pass this this legislation, would you please fax them to the number I gave? I would like each of you, please, to leave a phone number that you can be reached at for teleconferencing later today when we reconvene this meeting. I would like to say that no previous legislature can bind this legislature on anything that we do, and if we see fit to pass a law on anything, that's our business to do so. Mr. Tierney, could you tell me who all is certified? How many people do we have certified in this process?
There are, as we speak, all of the order is just being released today with respect to GCIs having been duly certificated by the commission. That order will be released today. It's with certain conditions. Last time, of course, is already certificated and has been previously as a monopoly provider. So there will be, by the close of business today, two competitors in the marketplace.
And what about MCI?
They have not yet, to my knowledge, applied for certification to participate in this marketplace. I don't know what they may be intending to do. They can speak for themselves.
Has anyone else applied for certification?
A local telephone company, Anchorage Telephone Utility, has filed with the Alaska Public Utilities Commission a notice of intent. It was filed to participate in the marketplace. We have yet to hammer out some of the particular format for a local exchange company to participate in the long-distance market. But they have filed a notice of intent to want to do that as soon as we're able to hammer out the particulars for local companies. But beyond that, there's no one else in the market, and there have been no other notices or formal applications to participate.
Would you also please this afternoon be ready to explain to me why only by someone applying for a certificate they're able to go and do this rather than after they have been certified? That seems to be a contradiction also in my mind. But I'm sorry, we are being called to the floor. We are losing our bridge. And please make sure that the L.I. Loyal there has a number. We will call them back to get numbers so that we can call you to continue this teleconference at a later time. 289 will be held at this time for further discussion later today. We had before us also House Bill 157 that I wanted to at least get a CS and 155 to get a CS before us. If we could...
somebody better go ahead. Sure.
No, what we'll do is that will also be on trying to get a CS before us. I'm sorry that we have not... that haven't got there. And that'll probably be the only other one that we're able to get before us today.
I wouldn't count on being added on
we're going to research for the Finance Committee. Right?
Yeah.
So what time should I be scheduled for?
One final note before you adjourn, if you can read me here.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to note that at last, I was aware the Senate State Affairs Committee is due to take up the Senate version of this bill, being HB 289, this afternoon at 1:30. I only note that just for your information. It is my intention to be down here at the LIL at that time for that purpose. Probably the other speakers here today also. Just FYI, sir.
All right, thank you. The problem we're having is we have no idea what time that we will recess the floor, and we're at the will of the Speaker of the House, so we're not able to set a time at this time, but we'll keep that in mind. We're off teleconference.
Did we get the phone numbers?
We called the LAO. I told them to.
Okay. Thank you for joining us.
We are adjourned to the call the chair. Heading back to order. This time I'd like to take up House Bill 67.
House Bill 67 by Representative Kopinen, an act relating to mistreatment of animals. This bill was in subcommittee. Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did produce a CS, which I believe you have, a blank CS dated 24th of April. It incorporated a dozen or more changes that were suggested by, I might say, extensive teleconferencing. If you thought you heard a lot at the regular meetings, it should have been at the subcommittee meetings. And rather than go through all of them, I would do two things. Just suggest I would try and answer any questions or ask the sponsors, staff to just give us a brief overview. Or maybe we should just kick this puppy out.
Don't say
that.
That was Tom's line.
I would entertain a motion to...
I would move the adoption of the CS dated 424, Mr. Chairman.
We have a motion for the adoption of the CS dated 424 by Udemol. Are there objections to the CS coming before us? Hearing no objections, we do have a CS before us. This bill has been worked on longer than any bill we've ever had. In fact, almost as long as some of us have been legislators.
Certainly true for me.
Can I move it out to next committee?
And the testimony...
would you characterize this as now being supported by the interested parties?
I believe so.
Yeah. Yes.
I'll entertain a motion.
Chairman, I would move that we report from committee CS for House Bill 67, State Affairs. Individual recommendations, I ask for unanimous consent.
Are there objections? There are no objections. House Bill 67, CS, State Affairs for House Bill 67. That's moved. Now you have to...
Is this later in Congress?
No. State Affairs, Congress. You have to get a copy of that. Individual recommendations. We heard House Bill 42 earlier today. We have a new letter from Representative Mulmer on House Bill 42. Would you review that? Do we have anyone from retirement here yet? No. Maybe we ought to just hold questions until retirement gets here on this, huh? If this addresses their concern. Representative Breckman?
Thank you. This change then would be mostly... benefiting the employee for retirement health benefits?
Okay. Well, the best after 5 years. But they would not be able to get the full health benefit until after 10 years, which would be the same as the full-time employee. Would you like to join us? Say your name again.
Representative Ballmer. This does allow a part-time employee to be vested in the retirement system, but it does not make them eligible for their health, their retiree health benefits until after they put in a full number of hours that the full-time employee has. And it is my understanding that it's possible, for instance, if a part-time employee worked 7 years in a part-time position, they would be vested and eligible for a retirement benefit, which is commensurate with the amount of hours that they have worked. Mm-hmm. They would be vested, but they still would not be eligible for a health benefit upon retirement. So we would have a group of employees who would receive a small, their small retirement benefit based on their part-time service, but would not receive health benefits. And that was the major expense to the state, was in providing those full health benefits for just the part-time service.
Trustee Brezner?
Thank you. I don't know how to state this. It's, I guess I would feel more inclined to help people cover health benefits, because I think health is pretty useful. And it's a savings in the long run.
Trustee Meyer?
In the memo, the last sentence of the second paragraph, this would then mean that a part-time employee could be vested in the system in terms of after 5 years. What does that mean, in terms of after 5 years?
Well, that's a typo. They're vested in the retirement system after 5 years. But in order to be eligible for health benefits currently, they must work the full number of hours that a full-time employee does. And this retains that provision of the current policy.
So you're saying, continuing to say then, that if someone works part-time for 5 years, that they can become vested. But does it address if someone works 2 years? And I guess what I'm trying to say is conceptually, something more like what we have already for the legislature, that you only gain your vesting if you work for 5 years. What happens to someone who doesn't work 5 years, and how's their time accumulated?
Well, if they work 2 years at half-time, it'd be like 1 year.
Is that correct?
Well, if they only work for 2 years, they're not vested, period.
Right, but if they have time credited towards vesting,
it'd be
if they
one
were
full
returned
year.
To the state.
Yes, it would be 1 full year.
So in 2 years, they earn 1 year. So that's in effect like what we do.
No, I'm sorry, the chairman was correct. If they have worked for 2 part-time years, that would be credited as 2 years.
Okay. Well, that's vested. What I'm objecting to. That I conceptually would like to offer now to make it more like the legislature, that if you work 5 years part-time, at the end of that 5 years, you'll get vested.
Right, but we tried to model this on that legislative. In regard to your comments this morning, we went back and looked at the statute and the regulations on that. So we wanted to make this the same, so that for each year of your part-time service, you get a year.
Right. Well, if someone works full-time for 3 years, and then they work half-time for 2 years, I'm saying I wouldn't want to see that equal 5 years. That would be 4 years. But if they don't get half-time credit and add it to full-time credit, they come up with a bigger number. But I have no problem with someone working half-time for 5 years and getting vested. It's just that interim period or combination. Sorry, I'm not being more clear, but that's the point I'm trying to get at.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond. I do understand what you're saying, and we did discuss that. In light of Representative Ulmer's desire to encourage people to take care of their family responsibilities and work part-time if they can, we felt that that would unduly penalize someone who is responding to the changing family circumstance. If you have worked 3 years and your aging parent, you know, becomes suddenly ill and incapacitated and you must care for that person, for instance, for a period of 2 years and until the parent recovers or dies or whatever, it seems to be perhaps too much of a hardship or a penalty to say, well, those 2 years we're only going to count as 1 year. So we did consider that, and we thought it would be perhaps more encouragement for part-time employment as a realistic possibility if we can get calendar year for calendar year.
Look, before we have any questions, let's have a vision retirements.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Stallnaker, the director for the Division of Retirement Benefits. In reading over the proposal, I would disagree that it would eliminate the fiscal note. It would eliminate much of the cost, because most of the cost is incurred because of the health insurance. It would also establish a different class of retiree under the PERS that currently doesn't exist. In other words, those that don't qualify to get health insurance and those that do. I don't necessarily think that's a good idea. I guess if the issue is to model it after the legislative staff employees working 5 sessions, then the bill as it currently stands does that. I And that's what the bill does, as Diane was saying. Because the legislative employees get health insurance. It's unfortunate there's a cost necessarily to that, but that's the reality of it.